Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Hello, everyone. Andy Richter here with another episode of The Three Questions. And I'm talking to an old pal today, and I'm talking face-to-face, which is always nice because that's a rarity in these disease-ridden times. But I get to talk to Ed Helms.
Hi.
Hi, Ed. How are you?
Hey, pretty terrific.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're here, I mean, aside from your love and devotion to me, because you're into this podcast game now too, right?
I'm diving in.
Is this your first attempt?
I feel like I've been on a million podcasts just in this capacity as a guest.
Right.
But yes, my first time hosting a podcast, and I'm really good at it, as it turns out.
I listened to the first episode.
Did you really?
It was really good. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Cool. No, I was being obnoxious by saying that, but I am really, really proud of it.
Yeah.
And it's a ton of fun.
How did it come together?
I had done so many podcast interviews, and I am I'm a big consumer of podcasts. Mm-hmm. So I really enjoy them, and I just was wondering, like, where do I fit into this space, or do I even fit into the
right.
podcast space? I didn't.
You do.
I do.
You do.
Okay.
Everyone does.
All right.
My mother does. It's such an elastic
sure.
form.
There's,
and it's like, sure, why not?
There's no standard.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You want to hum for 25 minutes? There you go. That's a podcast.
What was I just hearing? There are so many fun concepts out there. I saw Tig Notaro yesterday, and she was telling me about, who was it that has a podcast that's like picking up comedians at the airport? And it's called, like, Do You Need a Ride? I think
that's
Karen Kilgariff and someone else, Chris Fairbanks or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway.
It does present some logistic issues.
Like, I guess.
You need guests that are coming in, you know.
You just find out and you bring your tape recorder.
Yeah. People, I guess you just hang around the airport, too.
With your tape recorder, mm-hmm. right? That's what you use. So where was I?
Yeah, how it came together.
Oh, you know, I have a production company, and we're always making movies and TV shows, and we were thinking, okay, so what can we do maybe for a podcast? And we were sharing this with some of our good friends at Film Nation, and who had just started a podcast mm-hmm. branch, because everybody's doing it.
Right.
And they were like, hey, we're trying to figure out a way to make a show about this really cool history story.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always been a little bit of a closet history nerd,
mm-hmm.
and I'm out of that closet now.
Wow.
Yes.
Congratulations.
So, thank you.
Into the streets.
Uh-huh. And just
chanting history.
Yeah.
History.
And so they just were like, yeah, there's this story. It's about a NATO military exercise in 1983 during the peak of the Cold War, that the military exercise was interpreted by the Russians, the Soviets, as cover for actual war preparation.
Mm.
And there was tremendous fear on the Soviet side that a nuclear strike was imminent.
Right.
And so they, of course, then put all of their forces on high alert. It's a really wild kind of battle of psychological manipulation and misconceptions and all this. But basically, it's a moment in history where we may have been closer to an actual nuclear war than ever before, and no one knows about it.
Yeah,
like it was kind of buried in the CIA classified archives for decades, and only in about, I think, 1998. It was finally mostly declassified. And since then, it's still taken a ton of really aggressive historians getting Freedom of Information Act requests to get more and more information. And so really, the story is just emerging. And it's a wild story. It's full of espionage and it's deeply and darkly comedic. It kind of has these Kubrickian undertones. I don't know. It just feels like a dark satire.
Well,
but it's real. It's
100%
real.
The name of your podcast is SNAFU, which is an acronym for Situation Normal All Fucked Up.
Yeah.
And that is kind of like that pretty much expresses, because like I said, I heard the first episode. I don't know. Maybe it's just that when you are in the business of having enough weapons to destroy the Earth, that absurdities will follow.
Right.
You know what I mean? You're not just talking about blowing up a couple tanks.
Right.
You're talking about destroying the Earth. So it's already nuts.
Yeah.
It's already crazy. So of course then any extra wrinkles that are thrown in are going to be Kubrickian.
For sure. And when your policy is based on mutually assured destruction.
Yeah.
Like that's what's guiding your plan for nuclear missile armament. That's insane.
Right.
Right. And so what makes this situation, Abel Archer 83, especially insane is that the whole time that this is going on, we're being assured as a public that our foreign policy is perfectly legit. It's the best possible foreign policy.
Yeah.
And yet we were at this very, very scary tipping point.
Yeah.
I mean, when I say very scary, I mean existential tipping
of course,
point. Like,
of course.
Like the end of humanity.
Was this kind of the work of a lot of researchers and stuff? I mean, are you a writer on it too? Do you kind of sit in on that process?
Yeah, we have a great producing team between Film Nation and Gilded Audio and our partners at Gilded Audio and in my company, Pacific Electric. There are a handful of writers. I do a lot of editing and I did a couple of interviews. Our producers did a ton of interviews and it's a really collaborative process. We do a lot of listening together and noting and kind of editing. And the idea was we didn't just want to have a storytelling narration. We really wanted to build an audio experience, we wanted it to feel like a collage with narration. So one of our models, of course, is the mother of all modern podcasts, in my opinion, Radiolab, which just, really reinvented sound design or reinvented the use of sound design in documentary storytelling. And Jad Abumrad is a college friend of mine. We go way back, and I just think that he's a pioneer. I mean, everything that we're hearing now, it feels like a descendant of Radiolab in some way or another. And we are too. And we're a proud descendant of Radiolab. Yeah. And so that just means we've really paid attention to this kind of wanting it to feel cinematic, even though it's audio only, obviously. It's you're getting soundscapes. You're getting the dialogue is woven together. The interviews are woven into the narration. It's a fun, fluid listening experience.
Yeah. Yeah, lots of different textures.
Sure,
as textures. They say.
Audio textures.
Is this, aside from The Daily Show, which was nonfiction, but always playing for a laugh, really. I mean, is this the first thing you've done that's kind of a nonfiction kind of thing? Because up till now, it's been very much acting and mostly comedy acting.
Yeah. Well, of course, with the notable exception of The Hangover, which is completely real. And The Office, The Office was an actual documentary.
It was a documentary.
So
right. All those people were exactly who they were. Kate Flannery, what a drunk.
I think that this is It's a really nice kind of reference to The Daily Show because they do kind of rhyme with each other. They're sort of satirical storytelling based in reality.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I hadn't thought of that, but that's astute.
But is that something, I mean, is it something you'd kind of like to get more into? I mean, you know, now that you have a company and you're doing this, is it like, hey, this, you know, like maybe television projects or something that would do that?
I have to say, the more we dug into Abel Archer, the more it just feels like an exciting series or something.
Right.
I don't know what will happen, but yes, I think I enjoy a true crime podcast here and there, but I really do love, I love just storytelling.
Yeah.
And I'm
a sucker for based on true events.
Yeah.
I can watch the shittiest thing in the world, but if they're telling me it really happened, I'll stick it out, you know?
Yeah. Randall Park and I had a show on Peacock last year called True Story. And, and we would just sit down with people who had insane story, just like random insane stories from their lives.
Yeah.
You know, one guy tells the story of the night he saw Van Halen as a teenager, and it was like this odyssey of a night. This woman told a story of how she almost went into anaphylactic shock from allergies during her wedding vows, and you know, just all these crazy stories. And then we shot reenactments. You know, we did like heightened comedic reenactments that are kind of woven into the storytelling.
Yeah.
Kind of in the drunk history vein.
Yeah. But, yeah.
But
it's a great one because it, I mean, especially, I mean, how did you find people's stories? Did that just kind of everyone touched on people in their lives? Because everybody's got something nutty.
You know, we really had to dig because everyone has everyone has crazy stories,
right,
but they don't always necessarily translate into a good TV segment.
Right.
So we really scoured a lot of, you know, local news stories going back and then storytelling venues like The Moth on NPR,
yeah,
the great storytelling show, and lots of other just kind of storytelling contexts,
yeah,
that where people had already shared these things. And then we reached out and we wound up with a great, just a phenomenal group of people. And we shot a season of this show, True Story. It's really, really fun.
Yeah.
And I think what makes it special, to your point, is it does, like, it, you can't believe it's true.
Yeah.
Like, these are totally true stories, and they're so human because you're hearing the person who lived it,
yeah,
tell it. And Randall and I, we would sit down with the person, and our producers knew the story, but we didn't. Randall and I had never heard the story, so we would just hear it for the first time.
Right. And that's my level of prep. That's what I like. Go into a thing and it, on purpose not know anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Do I not have to do anything?
Yeah.
Yeah, sign me up.
Well, how much prep? None? Sounds like my kind of thing.
Even better.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that way, we were sort of the surrogate for the audience. Because we would then ask all the questions that just came to us organically. Like, wait, what? You did this?
Yeah.
You said what? And it's super fun. I don't know if we'll do another season or not, but man, that was a fun show.
Sounds fun.
Yeah,
I want to check it out. I wasn't even aware of it. Way to go, Peacock.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, did this love a storytelling? Because I'm the same way. I love stories. I love plot. And there's so many times I've lost so much sleep in my life watching something shitty and being like, oh, fuck, I gotta know what happens.
Yeah,
like,
totally.
It's not, you know, like.
Yeah. And
I imagine the villain dies.
Yeah.
Like, that's probably what happens, Andy. You can go to bed, but no, I have to see it.
I will say, like, at some point, and it was around Damian Lindelof's Lost.
Yeah.
Like, the creation of that show. It was right around there that the TV writing community really realized the kind of crystal meth of cliffhangers.
Yes.
Like that they can really hook you with a certain kind of storytelling by just introducing open questions.
Yes.
And then you are hooked because you just want to know the answers. And I remember watching Lost, and I have such deep respect for that show because I think it pushed a lot of boundaries at the time, but I'm also furious at that show because it
I watched one or two and I was like, I don't believe that these people know where this is going. I'm out. Yeah. Fuck you. If you don't know where you're going, I'm not getting in the car with you.
It's so fun. It is such a fun ride, that
I've
show.
I've heard.
But I will say there were so many times where I was like, hold on, guys. If that if this character would just walk over there and talk to this character, you could settle this whole plot line.
Yep, yep.
But you're just not letting them talk.
Yep.
That's infuriating.
Yep, yep.
And there was a lot
of
that.
Island.
Yeah.
Where there's only a certain amount of people. Like, they just won't mention it to each other.
But that said, they really found a way to just open questions that I feel like was revolutionary in storytelling. I mean, obviously cliffhangers have been around a long time.
Right.
I mean, even I remember the Dukes of Hazzard. It would have great cliffhangers when I was a kid. But like this way of just kind of constantly leaving you with like five things that you're desperate to know.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a all of a sudden so many shows were doing that.
They're in classic TV tradition too. They broke it. I watch one of my dorky dad shows is Forged in Fire, the knife making show. Have you ever seen that?
No, but I it sounds heavenly.
It's like four weirdos come in and they're given a challenge to make a knife, and then there's like knife makers and a hunky host, and then they make the knives. Every fucking act is a cliffhanger.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I just got to hammer this thing out, and then, uh-oh.
There's an impurity.
And then, cut to commercial, and then the uh-oh is just like, drop my hammer.
Oh, God. I got beard oil on the blade. Yeah. What do I do now?
Yeah.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium-iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at the coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Can't you tell my love's a crow? So cliffhangers now are done to death.
Yeah.
I mean,
it is interesting if you watch a lot of those shows, and there was about a year, maybe a year and a half, where my wife and I and a couple of friends were just had like a bachelor, addiction. Like we were watching it all the time and kind of just But obviously, and I think enjoying it in the way that most people do, which is like you just feel superior to everyone.
Yes.
And you're like,
yes.
But you're not. I mean, you're really not. But the funny thing is, if you watch.
you're watching them.
Yeah, exactly.
So who's really the,
Who's controlling
who? Yeah, who's in the high status position there?
But you do, if you watch enough of it, you really start to see a lot of patterns emerge. And then you're starting to see like the production.
Yep.
How the producers are manipulating the stories.
Yeah, you start to hear the producers' notes.
Exactly.
Like, you got to really be angry at her.
Yeah.
Or
like the producer is sort of teasing a question. You'll hear like four characters kind of answer the same rhetorical question.
Right.
And you're like, oh, clearly the producer sat them down and asked them.
I wonder where she was last night.
Yeah.
Where was she last night?
Yeah. Where was she last night?
Yeah.
You know.
And that's kind of when it I think a lot of people don't mind that. Like, they watch that, and that's part of the fun.
It's comforting, too, I think.
But then you start to see how the contestants on these shows also understand those patterns and those dynamics. They start to play into all of the archetypes and the roles, and like, oh, this person's clearly, like, chosen to be a villain, and they've chosen to sort of, like, be the mean, rude one, and they're getting a lot of mileage out of it, and they know it, and they're having a blast. And once I got so steeped in those patterns, I was like, this isn't fun anymore.
Yeah.
But I can appreciate how that's also kind of fun to watch it through that with that lens and kind of get it. But
that kind of TV too is always fun when you watch it with somebody.
Yeah.
You know, like it's something that like it's a shared experience. It's so much better than, you know, like if you're just watching it by yourself. Now you grew up in Atlanta, right?
Mm-hmm.
And was there like a lot of emphasis on kind of storytelling? I mean, was your family? They weren't really in any sort of creative type of things, were they?
No one was like in any kind of entertainment profession. But I will say, so I grew up in Atlanta, but I went to summer camp up in North Carolina in the mountains. And my mom worked at a camp I went to an all boys camp. She worked at a girls camp. It was kind of the sister camp. So we spent a lot of time up in Appalachia as a kid. And that's really where I think my love of mountain music and bluegrass. And I'm, you know, a big banjo player and all that stuff. But also the great storytelling traditions of Appalachia kind of seeped into me. And
So
we would have these visitors, you know, come to the campfire ceremonies at camp and they're like basically professional storytellers, but they were mountain people that would come and just, you know, tell these great old tales. And they go by different names. There are some that they call grandfather tales, and then there are some they call jack tales because they're derivations of the classic British fairy tales about Jack, like Jack and the Beanstalk and all that stuff. But they're different. They're through an Appalachian lens, so they're about these kind of like really clever characters, Jack and his brothers. Tom and Will, and you know, sometimes all three of them would be in a story, sometimes it's just Jack. They were colloquially just called Jack Tales. That's what I remember. And I just loved these storytellers that would come and sit, and just a whole, you know, 50 kids would sit on a gymnasium floor just wrapped in attention, and this person is just telling these wild tall tales, and they're ridiculous, you know. It might be a version of Jack and the Beanstalk, or it might be a version of, you know, Jack and outsmarts the devil, or, you know, these just riveting, awesome, wonderful stories that, you know, told by people who have really honed the craft of storytelling. And I think that really, really resonated with me. And I've collected some books of a lot of those old Appalachian stories, and they're so wonderful. They're just such rich tales, and
it's also kind of like something that we've been doing before we could write.
Oh yeah,
you know, I mean, it's like it's an old person sitting telling kids a story that's been told a million times before.
Yeah,
like, you know, we were just barely out of the trees and we started doing that.
Oh yeah, yeah, and you know, these great Greek epics and so forth, like that, you know, and these were stories were memorized by individuals. They're hours long, mm-hmm. right? Or it would take a week to tell a story, people just internalize these things.
Yeah,
you're right, but it's just it's such an incredible, I think, part of the human story is how humans craft narratives.
Yeah.
And the narratives help us make sense of the world. There's a lot written in psychology now about how you write your own story, like your own history. Mm-hmm. How you write that story can have dramatic effects on your mental health.
Yeah.
So if you look back on your life and you sort of like frame it as a struggle towards an optimistic outcome, you're going to have a healthier outlook on life if you look back and you tell your and your story is a struggle with a more difficult or downward outcome.
Yeah.
You might have more mental health struggles, and these are aren't just arbitrary things that we can choose to do.
Yeah.
These are kind of reflexive things, but there are ways, it seems, that the stories we tell, whether it's about ourselves, about our the worlds we live in, the relationships that we have, that can have really powerful impacts on our, like, sort of the prism that through which we see the world.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things that I have here is that you had like a serious heart surgery when you were 13.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering how impactful that was on just kind of the formation of a worldview. And I mean, had this heart condition like hampered you when you were growing up? Were you like one of those kids that your mom and dad were always worried that?
That's really funny. I remember telling this story on Conan, on one of my first Conan appearances.
Oh,
probably
really?
Like 20 years ago.
Yeah. And you haven't talked about it since?
Never. No. No one's ever brought it up. So it's an interesting question. I was diagnosed at birth with basically a heart murmur, which is something a lot of people have, and they can often be benign, but it's caused by some irregularity in the shape of your arteries, or in the shape of your heart chambers, or in the valves themselves. Some irregularity. I had a narrowing, like kind of an hourglass narrowing, on my aorta and pulmonary arteries. And so I had a kind of a double murmur, actually. And it was not a problem when I was born. It was just, it was something that was observed and noted. And my parents were told immediately, and they were very, very worried.
Yeah.
But we had this amazing pediatric cardiologist who became a dear, dear family friend, Dr. Plouth. And he basically kind of nurtured us all the way through, and the prognosis at that time was he's fine, you know, this kid is fine, but we're just going to keep an eye on it.
Yeah.
And then there's a chance when he hits puberty and has a growth spurt that the kind of relative difference in the deformity could become problematic.
Mm-hmm.
And it did. So when I hit about 12, they were seeing that these narrowing parts were not growing at the same rate as the rest of me.
Mm.
So they became worse, essentially.
Could you feel a physical effects of that?
Yeah. So most of my childhood, nothing at all. You know, I was a very rambunctious, active kid, you know, doing tons of sports and craziness. And then I think around 11, 12, I just couldn't keep up in gym class the same way. Like, you know, we'd be running around a track or something, and I was always kind of towards the back of the pack, if not last. And I was very frustrated by that, but I didn't notice that there was any problem. I just didn't have the same stamina.
Yeah.
And around that time, my cardiologist, pediatric cardiologist, was saying, yeah, I think let's start talking about surgery because we're going to need to correct this. Mm. And so it was a long ramp into the surgery, about a year where we were talking about it and kind of consulting with the surgeon, this amazing surgeon, Willis Williams, who has since passed away, but really like a remarkable pediatric cardiologist surgeon. And that's all to say it wasn't sudden. It wasn't something that was like, oh my God, he like wheel him into the operating room right away. It was this thing that had been building, and I'd had lots of tests, heart catheterizations, which are kind of these unpleasant tests where they stick a camera up your, what's the artery in your thigh? the big one.
Femoral.
Yeah. Is that your femoral?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so they
go in through your thigh and they put a camera.
They stick a camera all the way up into your heart
and
they can get a really good view of what's going on. And I'd had a few of those, and they had a really good idea of what the problem was and exactly how to fix it. And the surgeon was incredibly confident and reassuring. And yeah. So I think we were all, my family, my parents and me were all somewhat anxious, but also feeling fairly like this was an inevitable thing. And here we go. We're going into
this.
Was
it scheduled around school? Like, was it scheduled yeah. so it ruined your summer?
Yeah, well, so it was scheduled the first day of spring break. And so I went into surgery on, I think I went in on Monday, and then I was in the intensive care for a few days, and then the regular hospital for a few days. And then I was home after about 8 days recovering, and I recovered very quickly, because I was just a kid.
Yeah,
like I was just
yeah.
a really active kid. And I was back at school like 2 weeks later, but just sort of going for like a couple of hours.
Right.
And then coming home. And the real worry was not what my cardiologist said was, the thing I'm most worried about is some kid running by you in the hall and like bumping into you.
Yeah.
Because your sternum is still healing. Right.
Oh, wow.
Like it's such an invasive operation. And that's way more dangerous than anything you're going to do. Just
to your heart.
Yeah, actively.
Yeah,
now.
Yeah.
Like your heart is healing and everything's looking good. And then it was an incredibly successful outcome. I became a varsity swimmer on my high school swim team.
Oh, wow.
To just, yeah. And I see my cardiologist regularly now, and it's still a really great outcome.
That's great.
Oh,
I was really hoping for like it made you, like a dark weakling.
Yeah.
who then was shunned by society and then decided I'll get on the Daily Show.
Yeah. Lot of rage.
Yeah.
At the all these, the things that you can't control. It did give me a really powerful college essay because filling out my college applications and I had just seen Dead Poets Society and I was obsessed with Carpe Diem and I was like, this is So I just got a new lease on life because I got this heart surgery. And I was told that I would probably not have lived past my early 20s.
Wow.
And that I would have declined pretty rapidly
from
my late teens into my 20s and then died. And so knowing that, I still was just a rambunctious, bullheaded, idiot kid. And so that none of that really sank in. I don't think kids can process that sort of like existential insanity.
Thank God they can't.
Yeah.
It's a survival mechanism.
Totally. And you're so invincible as a kid.
Yeah.
But I did understand intellectually like, oh, this is something I can, I can spin into a good college essay. Yeah.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at the coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Can't you tell my love's a grown? When you went to college, what were you going to be? Were you still kind of in this kind of feeling of storytelling mode and music? And were you playing music by that time?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'd started.
Did you have a musical family? Because I've gotten the feeling, and I've been around you in a musical context, that you might do that if you had to choose one, acting or music. I feel like you might prefer the music.
I do. I love it so much, and my family was musical, but not seriously.
Yeah,
like everyone was good at singing, carrying a tune, loved singing. no one really played an instrument, but I think my mom could dink around on a piano. My grandfather in Nashville was really, he was very musical, had tons of instruments around.
Yeah.
And a lot of toy instruments that were so fun for us as kids. Mm-hmm. And I just really, I started taking, kind of dinking around on a piano when I was 8 or so. And then I got lessons, I think, when I was 10 or 12 on the piano. And then I got my first guitar at 13 and started taking lessons immediately. And I just had this awesome teacher who was exactly what I wanted. He was really steeped in a lot of the great folk traditions and bluegrass traditions. And he was an amazing banjo player too.
Mm-hmm.
And so he just taught me, just opened my brain up to all this awesome that I was curious about, but I didn't have any access to.
Yeah.
And he kind of saw that curiosity and was like, well, there's this.
Yeah.
And
you should listen to Bill Monroe and stuff like that.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's really, and then he taught me some banjo, and that was, that's how I got into that.
That was the gateway drug.
Exactly.
To the bluegrass, hardcore bluegrass junkie.
I actually, at that time, all I wanted to do was comedy. You know, yeah. I was, this is such a generic story, but it is also mine, which is that I had watched Saturday Night Live obsessively as a kid, like starting at 8 years old with you know, Martin Short and Joe Piscopo and all those guys.
Yeah.
And then watched it all the way obsessively through high school.
I think Martin Short would really be happy that those are the two names you picked.
Yeah.
He'd probably be like, oh, yes.
Me and Joe. Really?
Yeah. Frickin' frack.
Yeah. We were thick as thieves. So when I went to college, and I there was a thing on my college application that was like, you know, what do you want to be? And I wrote, like, I'm going to be in TV production. Because I knew I wanted to work in comedy.
Yeah.
And
you're probably a little too shy to say the, you know, like the boastful thing of like, I'll help people look at other people, not I want everyone to look at me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I was also very protective of my aspirations because I didn't come from a background that understood or supported that kind of aspiration. And not because my parents weren't supportive or my friends weren't supportive, but just because they literally didn't understand how anyone could do that.
How it works.
And I was like, I don't want to hear anyone's opinions. I don't want anyone to tell me I can't do it. So I just sort of kept it to myself. But I was very excited to go to a place like Oberlin, which has an incredible performing arts tradition across the board. Obviously, the music there is incredible. There's a conservatory that's world renowned.
Yeah.
And that was really
like
exciting to me.
One of the top two or three in the country. Probably.
Yeah. And I mean, in the world, it's up there. And then of course the theater and dance programs and all the arts programs are just a big deal there. And that just was very exciting to me. And I loved Oberlin. I had such a great experience there. And it really pushed me creatively, and then I graduated and went straight to New York City. I
was like, oh wow!
Yeah, jumped right in the comedy trenches. Right away.
Doing that.
Yeah,
I always wonder because I have a couple comedy friends who play banjo, and I wonder if Steve Martin was a inspiration to you for
it. Steve is a huge inspiration to me in a thousand different ways.
Yeah.
He's not the reason I took up the banjo.
Oh, okay.
I was...
Because I have a couple friends who play banjo, and it's like, it's kind of like, just Steve Martin did it. It looked cool. I liked the sound of it. You know?
Of course. No, I think he did so... He's really, in so many ways, an ambassador for banjo. Like a bluegrass ambassador. Because I think he's a point of entry for a lot of people. They're like, this is great.
Yeah.
This is just great music. And he writes such wonderful music on his banjo that I think just welcomes listeners and gets people exploring other stuff. But I got into the banjo. I got into that music because growing up in the South, I was a little bit of like an angsty adolescent. And I really had that kind of like Holden Caulfield complex of like, Everyone's fake. Everyone's a phony. Like I got to find the real stuff, like the most authentic stuff. And so I didn't, you know, everyone was listening to pop and rock bands. And I just was like, that's for the phony idiots. I want to find the source material. Like, where did this all come from?
Right.
And I sort of dug deep into blues and that, and then bluegrass and being up in the mountains in the summertime and having a little closer access to that world was incredibly exciting to me. And I just found it intoxicating. Like, this is the real deal. Like,
yeah.
This is the, and you know, it's just one more iteration. There's stuff before that, of course.
Sure.
But
yeah,
like,
yeah.
But to me, in my sort of simplistic analysis at the time, it was the origin. Like, this is early stuff. And
yeah.
I got sort of drunk on that, like, authenticity high of roots music, all kinds of roots music.
Yeah.
And so I became a bit of a snob in that.
I think also too, you have a gene for it or something. Because is there something about the kind of unchanging nature of it that gives you comfort or something? Like, do you like the fact that it's kind of timeless, and that, like, you can do bluegrass versions of more modern songs, but they're still bluegrass. Like, there's not like, you're not really going to, like, I mean, I'm sure that there's people out there doing it, but like, avant-garde bluegrass seems like a contradiction in terms, you know?
Well, there really is in the last 10 or 15 years. It goes back a lot further than that. But, you know, artists like Bela Fleck, who really pushed the banjo into incredible new horizons and into jazz
stuff. I mean, that's not bluegrass. You know what I mean?
Right. Like, no, it isn't bluegrass.
Yeah, yeah.
You're right. But there are, but when you say avant-garde bluegrass, I think of bluegrass as like an instrumentation. So like a guitar, a banjo, a fiddle, a mandolin, and a bass, and maybe a dobro. And that structure of a band to me is like a traditional bluegrass setup. And those kinds of bands, you know, with bands like the Punch Brothers and many others like them, are doing like really, really wild, cool, progressive, and fascinating, and riveting, exciting things that bluegrass bands traditionally never did. Now, the cool thing about the Punch Brothers is they can play the shit out of a Jimmy Martin tune, you know, and it's just the best bluegrass version you ever heard. And then they'll go into a Punch Brothers original that's just this like really cool out there progressive piece of music. And they can just vacillate between the two like no problem, because they're steeped in the traditions.
Yeah.
But just pushing boundaries. Chris Thiele is the mandolin player and really I think, you know, he's a great example, like Bela Fleck, who just took this instrument and was like, there's so much more that this thing can do than what the Cotton Eye Joe. Yeah, than what the bluegrass traditionalists have done. And I mean, mandolin has a rich classical history going back hundreds of years, but it also now, it's so fun to see the growth and progress of that art form.
Yeah. Well, how do you see your future unfolding? I mean, do you think, you're a dad, right?
Yeah.
And you know, do you think you're going to kind of continue to try and do more television stuff, or are you kind of going to be dilettantish and do a little bit of everything, you know?
I just have been so fortunate in my career to work with so many awesome people, and I've worked long enough and with a wide enough variety of people now that I kind of know who I want to work with.
Yeah.
And that to me is the most important thing now. It's like, I just want to be in work with people who are incredibly inspiring. And then I just get along with really well.
And the people you have to spend 12 to 14 hours a day with.
Yeah. Yeah. Or the people that just make me cry with laughter on a regular basis. And then I just want to spend time with my family.
Yeah.
And that's my immediate family, and also my extended family. We're really close with my wife's family and my family. And I feel really lucky it just to have a lot of things going on and to be at a place where I can be a lot more picky professionally.
Yeah.
I'm really excited and eager to cultivate music in some new and different ways in my life. And I at this point, I used to play out in Los Angeles pretty regularly at variety shows and stuff and with a lot of different musicians. I haven't done that in a bunch of years now, mostly because I think of fatherhood, but but I am playing a ton of music now with my kids. And
so
kind of for my kids. They're not they're not really playing yet. But I find myself just picking up a guitar even more than I have in a long time, just to have fun with them. And so I'm eager to, I don't know, I think music is gonna be a meaningful part of my professional existence in the, I don't know, in the near term.
Well, I mean, you've had some successes and some big franchises that kind of is a nice bedrock of security, you know? So, I mean, do you worry about like, oh, I can't be out of the public eye that much? Is that something that kind of, that you feel there's a pressure, like, you know, I'm going to be picky about what I want, but I can't be too picky because I don't want to recede too much from being on people's minds.
Yeah. There is always that gnawing insecurity that sort of your value as a, as like an actor or as a public figure kind of is a function of your exposure in different media. So I think, I used to really feel a lot of pressure about that and probably too much. I think to an extent, my insecurity was outran reality. Mm. Right. And so I was eager to jump into project after project, and I love what I do. And so I love to work. Now, I don't feel that same pressure. I feel some of it. I do feel like it's important to it helps your career to stay active, but, but I'm not, I don't feel the same urgency. And I really, like I said before, I'm so much more committed to just working on things and with people that I love, that are going to inspire me and keep me a happy person instead of just employed.
Yeah.
And you're right. I'm incredibly fortunate to be able to do that.
Yeah. The final of the three questions, which you didn't know what they were, although they are on the tip of everyone's tongue, is what have you learned throughout life? Like, what do you have like kind of a guiding principle that you know, your path through all of this stuff has informed you of?
I hate this question.
Well, all right. Just make something up.
Stay hydrated.
Yep.
That's one. Get a lot of sleep. That's another.
Yeah.
And this is just as hacky and trite as anything, but I've found that, I mean, it's hard to say cause it's so trite, but staying a student, right? Yeah. Like staying humble and staying curious.
Yeah.
And just never really, obviously we all want to feel confident. We all want to feel like we know what's going on and understand how to control our path through life as best we can. But just staying humble and remembering that we really don't know shit this world. And the more I will say that one of the kind of exciting things about the podcast space has been for me, I love psychology podcasts or like even some of the self-helpy stuff that's just like, you know, exploring different ways of thinking or being or interacting or ways that maybe that we don't understand ourselves. And so, yeah, I just think staying curious and staying humble and humble doesn't mean like small,
Yeah.
It just means like open to the ways that you may not understand things.
Yeah.
That you might be wrong.
Open is open is the word that I use, and I think of it now like being, you know, a middle-aged man, and I look at so many people older than me who are just closed, who are just like they've decided,
yeah,
I've seen all I want to see. I'm just going to kind of, you know, like those people that kind of pick a hairstyle when they're 28 and then just do it for the rest of their life. Like there's like a psychological, spiritual way of that. Like, nope, I decided this is the way it is. And then they just stay that way. And it just seems like dying before you're dead in a way, because you're not open to change. You're not open to, you know, and I think also it inspires a lot of fear.
Yeah.
Then if you decided I'm not going to introduce any new information, when new information comes along, you're like, no,
yikes. Sure. Yeah. I think that once you think you understand the world, once you think you understand your place in the world perfectly and how everyone else is either right or wrong in the way they move through the world, once you have those fixed positions, you're kind of screwed. You're going to just get angrier and angrier.
Yeah.
Because there's Carol Dweck, I believe, is the author who wrote a book. I think the book is called Mindset. And basically it's about this. It's about having a fixed or open mindset in how you navigate life and the value of an open mindset. It really leads to such a deeper sense of equanimity, because you can, when you have an open mindset, you can just accept outcomes that you didn't want a little easier, or you can accept your that you don't have control over things that you want. We all want control. We all want to be able to just move through the world exactly how we want and make sure everything stays safe and perfect. But it just isn't like that.
Yeah.
And I think having an open mindset just lets you navigate that with a little more grace and peace. It's funny, when I became a public figure, through which was sort of gradual through the Daily Show and then on The Office, and then The Hangover was just this huge tipping point, like, oh, now everyone knows who I am.
Yeah.
And that was incredibly exciting, obviously, for a million reasons, but also very terrifying, because there's no going back. And suddenly you, as a famous person, you can no longer control your environment, how you move through an environment,
right?
Because there's so many people reacting to you,
and you lose your anonymity, you lose the power of being invisible,
and that I think was terrifying. And it was a lot of this, you know, and now like trying to think through how to the value of relinquishing control and just kind of rolling with the way that it had to be, that reinforced some of these ideas for me.
Yeah.
Not only do we individually want so desperately to control our little micro environments, but we as a species need to control our macro environment.
Yeah.
And it can't end well.
No.
Like, can't we as a species be a little more, have a more open mindset?
We're learning, like, you know, it's like the planet is fighting back by the sea level rising.
I don't even know that I would characterize it as fighting back as much as just sort of like snickering at us. It's just like flicking us.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. Let's end it on that positive note. Way to go, humanity. The new podcast, Snafu, is it out now?
There are a few episodes out now. It's weekly, comes out on Wednesdays on iHeart, but it's anywhere you listen to your podcasts. It's you can get it. And
anything else you want people
check
to,
it out?
Any other stuff you want, you got out there?
Rutherford Falls.
Yep.
I'm so proud of that show. It's
and
on Peacock and the Randall Park show.
Yeah.
True Story. That's another recent one that I love. And I think That's a healthy dose of of Helms.
That's enough.
Yeah,
that's enough.
don't OD on me on Helms.
Well, Ed Helms, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate you spending the time with us, and I appreciate all of you out there spending your time with us too. And I'll be back next week.
The Three Questions with Andy Richter is a Team Coco production. It is produced by Sean Doherty and engineered by Rob Schulte. Additional engineering support by Eduardo Perez and Joanna Samuel. Executive produced by Joanna Solitaroff, Adam Sachs, and Jeff Ross. Talent booking by Paula Davis, Gina Batista, and Maddie Ogden. Research by Alyssa Grawl. Don't forget to rate and review and subscribe to The Three Questions with Andy Richter wherever you get your podcasts.
Can't you tell my love's a-growing? Can't you feel it ain't a-showing? Oh, you must be a-knowing. I've got a big, big love.
This has been a Team Coco production in association with Earwolf.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.